You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Very quickly, before we get into today's show, if you play Fantasy Surfer, now's the time to set in your team and send your wager in if you participate in that. This will be the last time you hear from me before the Quicksilver Pro France starts for the men's side of the WSL. All right, so if you're do that, great. If you don't, but you want to, go to surfsplendorpodcast.com, and there's a tab for Fantasy Surfer. It gives you all the instructions for how to participate in that. And you can find everything that you need there. All right. Thanks for playing. Enjoy today's show.
Why are there so many songs about rainbows? And what's on the other side?
Welcome back to today's show. I'm your host, David Scales. David Davis is the guest on today's show. Davis is a journalist and the author of the new book, Waterman, The Life and Times of Duke Kahanamoku. It is, in fact, the very first comprehensive biography on Duke, if you can believe that. I know a lot has been written about Duke, and we obviously mention his name often. And there's kind of this mythology that is developed around him. But in Waterman, Davis takes a very journalistic approach to researching the facts of the man himself. He provides social, political, and cultural context that helps, well, help me anyways, better understand Hawaii itself and just how astounding some of Duke's accomplishments really were. Because you already know a lot of the highlights of Duke's life, we really focus this conversation on just getting to know the personality of Duke. We discuss some of the adversity that he faced, which I was unaware of, financially, racially. And then we also discuss some of the misconceptions that the public has about Duke Kahanamoku. All in all, it was a really enlightening read, the book itself, and the conversation was a really enlightening one to have with David Davis. And it really just adds a lot of color and humanity to the iconic figure of Duke Kahanamoku. So anyway, enjoy this conversation. The book, Waterman, will be released on October 1st. Via Nebraska Press. We'll have a link to purchase it on surfsplendorpodcast.com. But of course, you can find it on Amazon or wherever you normally purchase books. And lastly, we recorded this conversation over coffee near Davis's home in LA, so you'll have to forgive any noise created by passing traffic. All right, here's David Davis.
I've heard it too many times to ignore it. It's something that I'm supposed to be. Someday we'll find it. The rainbow connection. The lovers, the dreamers, and me.
You're welcome to Keep This In. Duke Kahanamoku. Well, yeah, I mean, just on a general level, just an amazing story from perspective of American history and Hawaiian history. Somebody who was born in 1890 in Hawaii at the time when Hawaii was an independent kingdom. And by the time he was 10 years old, Hawaii was an American territory. And that changed the course of his life. In some ways opened doors that might not have been open to him. In particular, that he was then able to go for the U.S. Olympic team.
Right.
And at that time, you know, the Olympics were just starting out. They had started in 1896. So they were just starting to become a sort of a social force and a worldwide phenomenon that the media would cover. And Duke comes along and starts swimming competitively in 1911 and immediately sets world records. This is in Honolulu Harbor, and he swims at that time all outdoors. So you've got the current, dealing with tide, wind, everything, and wearing these ridiculous one-piece wool bathing suits,
right,
that, you know, must have slowed their times by seconds and seconds.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So he really starts as an athlete, even though this is, for the surfers and the surfing audience, he was surfing all this time, but he really gets fame and renown internationally as a swimmer. And in particular, he goes to Stockholm in 1912 and wins a gold medal in the 100 meters and a silver medal in the relay, and comes home a national hero at the same time as Jim Thorpe is coming home.
Right.
And again, to add another aspect to his life, I mean, he's a dark-skinned Hawaiian at a time when very few either African-American or, you know, non-white athletes have a chance to even participate in major sports. There's no, you know, there's the Negro Leagues. There's no blacks in Major League Baseball, that type
sure.
of thing. So that's really the start. And I sort of skipped ahead to talk about the Olympics. Duke was born and raised on Oahu in Waikiki for most of his life. So he was really born by the ocean.
Right.
Family grew up there in the area, Kalia, and which is now totally overrun by hotels, etc.
Yeah.
But at the time was sort of this, and not to romanticize it, but it was very much a haven, natural haven, fishing going on. Everybody sort of who lived there had a very close relationship to the water,
sure.
to the ocean. That was part of their world. And one of the reasons we titled the book Waterman is, and as I'm sure you guys know, it was such an important part of the Hawaiian culture.
Mm-hmm.
A waterman was, didn't matter what you were doing, you know, that you're a lawyer or a doctor, if
right.
you're a waterman, you were important. You knew the tides, you knew where the best fishing was, you knew when it was cool to surf at this point or that break,
right,
that sort of thing.
It's a name that's kind of been misused and overused now to refer to somebody who's really good at surfing or sailing. But I think at that time, as you're saying, it was you had to be good at everything.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
Number one for survival. Number two for acquiring food and that sort of stuff.
Absolutely.
So.
And transportation. I mean, you were a paddler. You know, you were a canoer. You were this and that. And it was this sort of all around game.
Right.
And I give a lot of I give a lot of credit to surfing for Duke's development as a swimmer.
Sure.
And I don't think some of the Olympic people understand that. I mean, the fact that he, at the time, at that time, we're talking, 16-foot boards?
Right.
125-pound
yep.
redwood planks.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, imagine running through the sand in that.
Yeah.
Imagine having to handle that and paddle out with that
yeah.
and balance on that.
Yep.
That's got to help your... That's like cross-training before there was such a thing.
Totally.
And this is, by the way, sort of going off on a tangent here, but this is, you know, before weightlifting or anything like that.
Right.
And when you look at photos of Duke, I mean, he's this muscular, you know, well-built dude. And I give a lot of credit to the fact that he was surfing and, mm-hmm. and what he had to do to surf in those years. And that could only have helped his swimming.
Sure. You've kind of made reference to it a little bit through the things that you've just said, but can you paint a picture of Hawaii culturally and politically, you know, in 1890 when Duke was born?
Yeah, very complex. It's in its placement in the Pacific. It's in sort of the crossroads of the Pacific. And so there are a lot of influences at the time and a lot of competing nations who see Hawaii as this very strategic spot in the Pacific. And at a time when on the mainland, there are a lot of political commentators who are expressing interest in America going beyond the mainland.
Right.
And moving its sphere of influence beyond just the continental U.S. And that's a change coming out of the Civil War, et cetera. That's
sure.
a change. And so there's quite a bit of talk in Washington about the importance of Hawaii. So we know the American interests, and there are certainly some of the missionaries who had landed there in the early 1800s. They're now two or three generations on. So that's from the American point of view. There's also Japan starting to spread its influence out beyond its borders and beyond Japan. And there's the European powers, who are, of course, very, very strong. Germany, Prussia, and England, who have interests in the South Pacific and beyond. So Hawaii's seen as this very exotic place. Not many people have been there by then. It's a long ways from, you know, continental, you know, the west coast of the United
sure.
States and Japan. It's seen as this idyllic place, and yet it's seen as the strategic place. And at the time, and you asked about Hawaii, at the time it's controlled by a monarchy, but their power has been diffused. And a lot, for various machinations, which will take another podcast.
Sure.
For various machinations, their power has been reduced. And so in 1890, when Duke is born, there's sort of this tug of war going on as to who will control Hawaii in the future. And as we find out, it is America who sort of, in various ways, not all ways that we are very proud of in some ways, I would say, take over Hawaii. And as I said, it changes the course of Duke's life. It changes the course of Hawaii and Hawaiian culture, and this idyllic spot is now going to be part of, you know, American hegemony in terms of military.
Mm-hmm.
And it does become, very early on, they start building out Pearl Harbor
sure.
as a strategic naval base and other interests in American military.
Mm.
And that's part of our legacy, good,
yeah.
bad, or indifferent.
Absolutely. We'll carry on with Duke's kind of biography, but before we do, I'm interested in what was your objective with writing the book? I mean, there's obviously a few Duke bios out there, maybe not super comprehensive versions,
right.
but what was your objective with the book?
Yeah, I mean, it on a very basic level, it was to tell a story of someone, of Duke, who I did not feel had been, had not had the full treatment of a comprehensive biography.
Okay.
And yes, there have been quite a bit of works done on him, but I felt that the full sort of treatment was not there. And I'll be honest, I came about it, and I brought this to show you.
Yeah.
This was the first book I did, and this was about the 1908 Olympics.
Okay.
And it's called Showdown at Shepherd's Bush. And this was about the 1908 Olympics, and followed three characters who competed in the marathon race. And there was some spillover to 1912. And so I was researching the 1912 Olympics, and there's been a bunch of biographies of Jim Thorpe and so on and so forth. And I looked around for a solid, comprehensive biography of Duke, and I didn't see one.
Yeah.
And I'll be honest with that. If I had seen one, I probably wouldn't
sure.
have done it.
Sure.
I felt that I felt that Duke was a man whose legacy had been overlooked. mm-hmm. in certain ways. I think he's been venerated in the surf community.
He has,
in a very positive way, in a great way. But I think his Olympic career has sort of been overshadowed. I also think his role as a pioneer in race, in sports, in mm-hmm. America, has totally been overlooked.
Yeah.
And
well, so a lot of different sports too. I mean, we kind yeah. of the surfing community knows him for spreading surfing throughout the world, but as you point out in the book, beach volleyball, stand up paddling, there's a lot of other things as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I take it even a step further now, and so you look at, I mean, we in the surf community, it's, you know, he's the godfather, the father of sure. modern day surfing, and I think that's pretty accurate. I would say he's the godfather of really extreme sports, because you don't have skateboarding without yeah. surfing.
Right.
You don't have snowboarding without surfing.
Sure.
And so if you trace those all back to Duke, well, that's an amazing legacy.
Mm-hmm.
That's an amazing legacy. And anyway, that's what I wanted to get at. And I write in the introduction, there's been so much myth built around him.
Right.
I also wanted to see, hey, let's get the facts straight.
Sure.
And then people can judge or not judge
yeah.
What's happened on things.
I think you successfully do that. I think,
thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, the book is written very clearly, and there's obviously a lot of fact in it that just is easy to digest and understand. And it doesn't separate any of, I don't know, my ideal of him. It just kind of props up the ideal that I already have of him.
Cool.
So I think it's really well done. What were some of the inaccuracies that you found? Or are there any legends, let's say, that you found to be historically inaccurate?
Ooh, yeah, there's a long list, and partly I give some of the blame to Duke.
Okay.
Because I wish he had just sort of said, well, this is the way it happened, you
right.
know, here.
Well, that's not to say, though, that he was like a self-promoter hyping no. himself. It was the opposite, right?
Exactly.
So you're saying he should have just, rather than sitting in the background,
he should have set the record straight.
Right.
But you're right. His personality was to be unassuming and
right.
not to boast or anything. And the few interviews that he did, they would always, and it was so frustrating as a researcher, because they would always just talk about the same things.
Right.
And I was sitting there in the background listening to these old interviews going, ask him about this, ask
sure.
him about that. So a few things, and some of these I haven't been able to resolve because there wasn't the concrete evidence, which is also sort of frustrating. But one thing that's been written a lot about as a swimmer was his big race against Johnny Weissmuller at the 1924 Olympics. And the buildup of this race was like 2 years coming.
Mm.
And Johnny had gone to Hawaii to challenge him. Duke had been sick and was moving to Los Angeles, so they didn't meet. They only met for the first time at the Olympic trials. And Johnny won. Johnny Weissmuller was in his prime, was probably better than Duke in Duke's prime, but was just younger and well-coached. Duke was older by this time. But there was this thought that he would nip Johnny at the Olympics. Anyway, cut to Paris. They line up, and the myth has always been that Johnny raced against Duke and Duke's brother, Sam Kahanamoku, and Johnny was in the middle between them, and he was frightened because, you know, he's surrounded by two brothers, and he was worried that, you know, how is he going to handle this and so forth. And there's a whole mythology built around the guys before the race, what they were saying to each other, that sort of thing. Well, we have the photos of that race, and Sam is in lane one, and Duke and Johnny are in like lane five and six or something. Mm. So they're not scrunched
right.
up together. And this whole mythology has been built up of them shaking hands and doing this. Not true at all.
The mythology is more dramatic.
Exactly.
I like it. I want to believe it.
Exactly. In terms of surfing, there's a lot of mythology about was Duke the first to do,
sure.
you know, dot, dot, dot. And was he the first to surf Australia
sure.
when he went down there in 1914, 1915? a lot of his Duke's boosters and historians have said, oh yeah, he brought it down there, and after that it all, you know, Australia adopted surfing and, you know, dot dot dot. Well, probably there were a few people surfing before Duke was there. I mean, and he's quoted as saying, oh, all these surfers, he was out in Sydney, and oh, all these surfers around. Wow,
okay.
lot of crowd here.
Right. So there's not necessarily evidence that those people exist, but he references it.
Yes.
Right.
Same thing with surfing. People have said, oh, he was the first to surf, to bring surfing to California. Well, not really. We know George Freeth was here, gosh, 1908, 1910, that era.
Yeah.
He had been brought over to surf in South Bay, Redondo, and in that area. And we knew there was a little bit of surfing action in California. So that sort of thing.
Well, I'm interested in terms as a researcher, like there's a rich tradition of like oral history in Hawaii for sure, and at the same time there's people who still live that existed that were friends with Duke, like Paul Stroud Jr. and stuff like that. And
right.
I actually interviewed Dave Parmeter like last month or so, and for the podcast, and we were just kind of commenting how like oral history certainly leaves gaps in inaccuracies in terms of detail, but what it does successfully is kind of convey the vibe of the experience or the theme or whatever. I'm wondering, what was your process for researching the book? Who'd you interview? That sort of stuff.
Right. Well, I interviewed as many people as I could. And that was totally enlightening. Somebody like Paul Strau was incredibly helpful. And would, if I ran into something that I couldn't understand or wanted to ask, I pick up the phone and call Paul or see him somewhere at an event. Totally open and totally, totally great. There were others, frankly, in Duke's family and in Hawaii who did not want to talk to me.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I don't take that. I didn't take it personally. I understand. I'm not sort of part of that world.
You know,
I'm here in Southern California. I'm sort of researcher, writer guy, and I respect their that they didn't want to talk to me. I'm disappointed, but I can do.
Not to steer you off the point, but just as a side note, one thing that I found interesting was that Duke's wife basically donated the estate after she died outside of the family, and so it seems like the family, maybe not all the family, but some members of the family feel like they've lost a little bit of control over the legacy in that respect.
Yeah, and that's a huge point, and it was and I think one of the reasons for some people's not wanting to talk to me.
And
they were polite. It's not like they slammed doors in
no,
my face.
Sure.
They were just polite and said, you know, I'm good.
Right.
Thanks.
Sure.
And there were probably, I mean, you mentioned Paul Stroud, and Paul was great. But remember, Paul was, you know, a child when Duke was older.
Sure.
You know, Paul's 25 when Duke is 75 or
right.
so.
Right.
So Paul didn't know Duke, you know, there's
when Duke
only
was young, yeah.
Yeah, there's only a few people still alive who have that. I was only able to interview a few people.
Got
on
it.
That. And that's disappointing, and I as a researcher writer, I own that, and I go, you know what, there's maybe room for other Duke Kahanamoku biographies if there's stuff that people have that I wasn't able to uncover. But I certainly made a lot of trips to Hawaii. That was the basis of my research.
Yeah.
And uncovered every interview I could find of Duke, whether it was going to, or about Duke, whether it was going to New York or North Carolina or wherever to find those tapes and to listen to them and hear his voice and try to get it that way.
It'd be interesting to see how the book's received by those people who maybe declined to be interviewed, and if they'd be more willing second time around.
Agreed. Yeah. Agreed. And I hope they will take the time to read it and
yeah.
comment on it, and and see how I did.
Yeah, totally. What was the most surprising thing that you learned through that process of researching?
Surprising. Ah, yeah. This is going to sound, not self-serving, but I honestly didn't know how big a hero he was. I didn't know how big a figure he was.
Yeah. The hero's hero, as I think Pesman or somebody put it.
Yeah. And, I mean, in a sense, I didn't know what I was getting myself into.
Sure.
And maybe that, in that sense, ignorant was bliss because I might have been intimidated.
Yeah. Totally.
But there was a comment that a reporter made, Bob Considine made, about Duke. And this is after Duke had retired and he was the sheriff of Honolulu and, you know, sort of in his dotage a little bit. And Bob's comment was, Duke Kahanamoku is, in Hawaii, is Babe Ruth and Jack Dempsey combined. And when you think about that, that's huge.
Huge.
That's huge.
There's nobody comparable, really.
There is nobody comparable. And that's the most surprising. He was that big. And I don't think there's... And I tried to find a sports hero who you could say was so closely identified with a place and with his, either where he was born and raised or where he became a hero or whatever, than Duke.
Well, that's a great point.
I don't think there's anybody so intrinsically
synonymous,
synonymous with Hawaii and Hawaiian-ness and Waikiki and, you know.
Well, let me ask you this. I think it's pretty evident how Hawaii informed Duke. How do you think that Duke has, you know, informed Hawaii?
Well, great question. And a difficult question because I think before I answer it, it in some ways one of Duke's biggest roles was to educate the world about Hawaii and to show Hawaii, here I am. And you know, his mantra was about the aloha spirit and
right.
This welcoming vibe that he gave off. And I think that's what he brought to the world. And I think towards the end of his life, he regretted some of that. He regretted
really?
This welcoming because he had seen, you know, by the time of the end of his life, we're talking, you know, 1968. So Honolulu and Waikiki was... built up,
sure,
with, you know, hotels and condos and tourists and all that, in a way that was starting to, you could start to see the slippery slope that was headed.
Yeah.
And it involved surfing to some degree, that the surf spots were getting overrun.
Right.
And not just by more people, but also the environment. And there were a couple of instances where he was fighting to preserve reefs and things like that. And I don't think he, you know, if you had told him
sure.
down the line, this is what's going to happen to your homeland, you know, he was so proud of his homeland. He was so, you know, he wanted people to love it as much as he did, that in a sense, I think he felt a little bit that it had gone overboard.
When you're hiring for a small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role, and there's no faster or effective way than through LinkedIn Jobs. Your time and capital are precious, and there is a powerful resource that can help you focus on what you're good at and integrate people into your team seamlessly to help grow your business. LinkedIn Jobs has created the tools to find the right professionals for your team efficiently and for free. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. Everyone is already on LinkedIn with their resumes and references, and now LinkedIn has designed a hiring platform to connect you with candidates specifically qualified for the job that you post about. More than a billion professionals meticulously organized to connect people by skill set to help us all advance our position. 2.5 million businesses already use LinkedIn for hiring, and 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. It's that fast, easy to use, and effective. LinkedIn Jobs can help you write job descriptions, filter the right person to you, and give you the tools to help you interview them like a pro. LinkedInJobs.com/surf is where you go to post your job for free. Yes, totally free. That's LinkedInJobs.com/surf to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
Well, what I would argue for Duke would be that all the tourism and all that stuff was going to come with or without Duke. And I think that it's important to have somebody there, you know, championing Aloha and the preservation and all that sort of thing. And that he was obviously the best guy for it. So maybe he expedited the process by 10 years or something. But if we didn't have him, who knows what it would be like today?
Right. No, and he didn't single-handedly do this.
No, of course.
And, you know, I think World War II really accelerated the process because there were so many veterans and Army and Navy personnel who, you know, went through Hawaii and then when they went home, you know, to the East Coast or to Cleveland, said, you know, I maybe want to go back to Honolulu and live there.
Yeah.
And they were smart about that.
So let's get kind of back to his timeline and biography. Yeah. Basically, champion, you know, medalist, swimmer, surfer, just as recreation and hobby. But because of his celebrity status as an Olympian, was able to travel the world and then just spread surfing, basically, which might not have been his intention, but it was what he enjoyed doing when he went to places that had coastline. I'm curious, or one thing that I kind of, I don't know that I had ever really thought about it until I read the book, was just financially, how do you travel the world, you know, and what is his source of income? And it turns out that he had a lot of different jobs throughout that time and didn't necessarily ever have a tremendous amount of financial success throughout his life, struggled, in fact, financially at times. What did it look like, basically?
Yeah, no, you're right. And it was a central element of his life and controversial. And you asked me before about maybe some of the things that surprised me in the research. One of the things that did surprise me was that, for instance, in 1913, after his Olympic success, the fans and the people of Hawaii contributed money for a fund for Duke, and they bought him a house and his family.
Just as a thank you for putting Hawaii on the map, basically?
Exactly. Right. And to say, hey, you know, and they recognize that, hey, this, look, Duke was a high school dropout.
Right.
His family, you know, his dad was working with the police department, but, you know, they had eight kids.
Right.
You know, together. And so they were fine. They always had food. They were doing okay, but they certainly weren't, you know, reaching out into the next class.
And for Duke enable for him to win the medals, it's kind of like you have to devote a lot of time towards swimming.
Exactly.
Can't devote a lot of time towards a day job.
Exactly. Yeah. And yet, what's interesting about that house, almost as a symbol, it should have disqualified him from swimming in the 1920 Olympics and 1924 Olympics. In other words, back then there was an amateur code. The Olympics were strictly amateur. You could not receive money, and that's what got Jim Thorpe into so much trouble.
Right.
After his, and he got stripped of all his medals.
Right.
The Hawaiians who helped Duke get this house were very smart. They put it in a trust, and he was able to keep swimming as an amateur, even though he was technically a professional.
Sure.
So that's one example of how, over the years, he did get help from the community. They supported him. The Hawaii Tourism Council, in a sense, supported some of his efforts when he needed money to go to swim meets in San Francisco, for instance. They would pay his way and help him get there.
Right.
And in return, he was expected to be, you know, the ambassador of Aloha.
Sure.
And he performed very well. He would oftentimes, if there were events or something, he would be appearing. He would, he would go to World's Fairs and represent Hawaii there, and then swim at the swim meet on the side and so forth.
Right.
So he sort of cobbled together a living. There were times when it was patronage. There was times when it was sort of controversial. He was for a time basically, you know, a janitor of
right.
sorts, and yet he knew he had to work. So he sort of took it, and eventually he was positioned by the powers that be to run for sheriff. And once he attained that position, which was in the mid 30s, he was basically okay.
Had a little more stability. Yeah. But he was, you know, in his 40s at that point.
At that point, right.
Yeah.
And, you know, when he got married towards the end of the decade, at the time when he and his wife went to buy a house, they had to get a loan from a friend to
right.
buy the house.
Yeah, exactly. Very different than modern times where you can, you know, brand yourself and do all sorts of commercial endorsements and stuff like that,
right.
which he did later in his career, obviously.
Yes. In the 60s, and that's a totally interesting chapter, really when he gets aligned with surfing to the degree that he's so aligned with surfing today.
Sure.
But it is interesting. He did do an endorsement, and again, he should have been banned from the Olympics, but he did an endorsement for a product, and it probably the first endorsement by a surfer.
Yeah.
You know, Valspar, which was a
right.
which was like a shellac that he used for his surfboard, or he
right.
said he used for his surfboard.
Right.
So
I've got a list of a couple of careers just that I'll mention.
Yeah.
We don't have to discuss at length, but he was a draftsman in the public works department, which is just a normal 9-to-5 job basically.
Yeah.
Obviously he did some Hollywood acting.
Yes.
Which kind of the interesting detail about that in the book is just that, you know, he's never fully accepted as a leading man. It's more playing ethnic roles, that sort of thing. He was a lifeguard, obviously, as you mentioned, sheriff of Honolulu, to which he was reelected 13 times.
Yes.
It's
yes.
pretty impressive.
Yes.
And had a little bit of a political career as well. He advocated for statehood.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the Hollywood chapter.
Right.
We talked about adversity that he faced financially. Can you tell me more about adversity that he faced, maybe racially or otherwise? Because
yeah.
we just think of him as just being this hero, but come to find out, it wasn't that easy.
Right. And again, I think the Hollywood chapter, I think, breaks some ground from some of the other ones, which either sort of lightly go, oh, and he was an extra in these movies, and they'd name a bunch of movies and then move on. Or they would say inaccurately, oh, he was a Hollywood star. Well, he was nothing close to a
sure.
star. He did have a name, a big name, an Olympic name, and Hollywood is attracted to that, always has been. And there were certainly movies where his name was up there. But at the time, the color line, so to speak, was as drawn in Hollywood as it was in professional sports.
Got it.
And there would be no way that you could have sort of the dark-skinned man be the romantic hero
right.
or the swashbuckling guy to get the girl and so forth. And, I mean, I bring this up in the book. I mean, how cool would it have been to have Duke be a surfing hero, you know, in a series of shorts in which, you know, he could have rescued people, which he did in real life, and done some things that would have shown off surfing way before, you know, the 60s and the 50s when surfing movies become real.
Absolutely.
Big. Somebody with imagination could have done that
right,
with
right,
Duke,
right, right.
and they just didn't get him. And they didn't also get his personality.
Right.
He was quiet and so forth, but when you see him, rare glimpses on the screen, I mean, he really pops out.
He's got it.
He's got it.
Yeah.
There's a short. There was a comedian named Charlie Chase. He was sort of below the Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin, Harold Lloyd guys. But he and Duke were pals. I think they were members of the Los Angeles Athletic Club together.
Okay.
And there's a short that he did, and you see Duke on the beach lounging, and you see him running, you see him swimming, actually, and we have very few clips
yeah.
of him.
Right.
And he's just I mean, your eyes just are drawn to him.
Yeah.
And I feel, I mean, it was sort of heartbreaking to go over that Hollywood career, because I think he came here with some expectations that he would be a star.
Yeah.
And very soon it became apparent that he really wasn't. But as you say, he made a living for a while. I think at the time he was a little discouraged by what was going on in Hawaii, to be honest.
Okay.
And he needed a break. And he had friends here in Southern California. He was sort of adopted by some leaders of the Los Angeles Athletic Club, and it sort of gave him a home for a while.
Yeah.
As he was transitioning from, you know, competitive Olympic swimmer towards, okay, what's next?
Right.
You know, which is not easy for any athlete.
Sure.
Elite athlete.
Sure.
To transition to.
Well, there's that, but there's very specific examples of him, like, being denied service in restaurants and stuff like that because of the color of his skin.
Correct. So. He was, I mean, Hawaiian, you know, it was rare. It was a rare sighting at
right.
that time. There wasn't as much, you know, you had to get on a boat to get across. So not that many people, only the rich could afford to go to Hawaii. So when Duke was over here, he was often apparently mistaken as African-American or Native Indian. And there were occasions, and he didn't talk much about this again. And again, if I could have put myself back in time to interview him, it would have been to say, what happened with that?
Right.
What were those incidents like, and how did you feel?
Yeah, how did that affect him? And
right, and it must have. It
yeah.
must have been, I mean, here you are a gold medalist, and you can't get a meal at a restaurant.
Right. I wanted to ask you just to retell a story or two that you found particularly interesting. The one that I pulled up is one that's been told a lot, which maybe you want to tell this one, maybe you have another that you find more compelling, but just about him, you know, rescuing the eight people in Corona Del Mar yeah. is a great story.
Yeah, that's the one I was going to pick
yeah.
Because it's so amazing. And actually, I was mentioning that Charlie Chase, mm-hmm. he had just filmed that. I was able to figure out, like, he had just filmed that, and they took a break with some buddies from the Los Angeles Athletic Club. They went to Corona Del Mar, which at the time was probably the primo
vacation.
Surf spot.
Oh, surf spot.
Yeah. It was before some of the jetty had
yeah.
been built out, and at that time it was among the best.
Yeah.
And they had been exploring that site for a couple years, and Duke had been coming over since 1913, so they knew this spot well. So they were down there to do some surfing. It was, I guess, June of 1925, and the waves were kicking up that day, big time. And a fishing boat from Riverside, or a fishing boat that was manned by a guy from Riverside, California, full of people just going out to get some abalone, went out. And as they were trying to get out to the ocean, they got slammed by these waves, and the ship called the Thelma got capsized, turned over, and these guys are flailing in the water. Duke is watching all this from the sand, from the beach. He grabs his board and paddles out and just starts manhandling these guys and putting them on his board, paddling back in, while all this, you know, craziness is going on with the ship and people screaming and yelling. He goes out, they say, three times, rescues eight people who probably would have lost their lives.
So puts a couple on the board, paddles them in, heads back out, couple more, paddles them in,
right.
heads back out the third time.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
And, you know, the other guys are sort of working over the people he's rescued, whether it's CPR or some sort of just holding them and rescue, you know, putting them in. And by the end, you know, several people did die. And Duke, again, had like one line to say about rescuing all these people. He just said basically, well, it had to be done and I did it.
Yeah.
And, I mean, he was given all sorts of, he was given awards by the Los Angeles Athletic Club and so forth. But, my gosh, it
single-handedly rescued eight people.
Right. And in so doing, he also showed the importance of a surfboard.
Right.
That it wasn't just this you know, this crazy thing that Hawaiians did to have some fun. No, this thing has some use.
Right.
And certainly in Southern California for lifeguarding and so forth, it became a tool.
Absolutely.
And I think that was really the importance of it. And I think, and Duke, he wasn't the first to do this. He would say that George Freeth had done this as well. But this certainly, because of Duke's fame, this got out there and this was headlines all over the place.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, amazing story.
Really an amazing story, yeah. So, tell me about Duke's kind of later career once he ends up back in Hawaii and some of his political ambitions and that part of his life.
Yeah, he comes back to Hawaii first in about 1929.
Okay.
After the 28 Olympics. He goes back for a little bit in 1932 to try to qualify for the 32 Los Angeles Olympics. Is unsuccessful in that. And then returns and basically is full-time in Hawaii for the rest of his life. At the time, there had been some turmoil. Hawaii was starting to really change by this point. There was quite a bit of tension racially. There had been a major episode of violence between military personnel and some Hawaiian people regarding an alleged rape, which probably did not happen. So there was quite a bit of turmoil there, and Duke was sort of positioned to run as the run for sheriff of Honolulu County by the Republican Party, and he was sort of seen, and I think this is valid, as a unifying figure, somebody that, you know, basically everybody could trust. You know, Hawaiians could trust,
right?
Haoles could trust. Others could trust, you know, Asian, so forth.
A lot of Asian immigrants had come over to work on sugar plantations.
Correct.
And that sort of thing. Right.
Correct. And, in fact, the Asian population was far exceeding
right.
Others at this time.
Even the native population.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So there was this feeling that he sort of represented stability and tradition, and he was positioned to run for that, and he won. And so from the about 1934-35 on until 1960, basically, when Hawaii becomes a state and eliminates the position that he had won, that's his work. He's the sheriff. at the same time, in 1939-1940, he becomes romantically involved with the woman who would become his wife, Nadine Alexander, and they marry in 1940.
White yes, woman, Caucasian?
A white divorcee who had apparently, according to her, had seen Duke when she was a kid in a magazine and said, "Oh my God, that's the man I want to marry." And
yeah.
Sure enough, does.
Yeah.
And they, by all accounts, were very different, but also very loving couple at the same time. There was an age difference, and she was, you know, quite a bit younger. But by all accounts, they were a happy couple, even though they were sort of different.
Sure.
And so that's Duke's life. I mean, he gets involved. He tries to get involved in some business and doesn't quite, you know, always sort of just misses out. There are two examples. He was sort of given an early chance to be part of the swim fins, which were invented in the, you know, late 30s, early 40s. And it was a guy who had been an Olympic teammate of Duke's, and that opportunity goes by the wayside. Hollywood producers had called. They sort of wanted him to do a version of sort of what became, let's just say, Hawaii 5-0.
Yeah.
And he negotiated and eventually turned that down.
Yeah.
So he didn't never quite got ahead financially
right.
until really the 60s when he gets a promoter behind him and really backs him and his name. And they start exploiting, and I say that not in a necessarily a negative way.
Sure.
But they start exploiting his name and as the brand, the Duke Kahanamoku brand.
Yeah, and that's Kemo McVeigh, right?
Correct.
And that's
correct.
Where Duke's restaurant comes into play and
correct.
That sort of thing.
Correct. The nightclub becomes sort of the Duke's nightclub,
sure.
which is separate from the Dukes that we know now in Huntington or Malibu or in Hawaii.
Yeah.
But that becomes the hottest, you know, spot in Waikiki and in part because of Don Ho.
Right.
So.
Yeah, which he brought on as a entertainer, basically.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So there's a lot of kind of tangents and a lot of different arms of, or, you know, branches of the tree that branch out from Duke, obviously. Yeah, I was surprised to learn in the book something I really didn't know, and I guess in hindsight I saw, but I didn't really pay attention to it, which is just all the benefactors that he had in his life.
Right.
Like you're saying, he's kind of almost super successful a couple of times, but really he was an athlete and a performer, not necessarily a self-promoter, not necessarily a businessman. He just was the performer. And gratefully or thankfully, he had a number of benefactors from Bill Rawlins, Doris Duke, which was a romantic partner at some point who has kind of a tobacco legacy.
Allegedly Harris. Romantically involved. We have to say that.
You have to say that. I know.
Right.
Arthur Godfrey, yeah. Kemo McVeigh later in his life, which right. all just kind of propped him up. And it doesn't seem like anybody really did it to take advantage of him. They all genuinely wanted the best for him and saw opportunities and were able to kind of support.
I believe that. I mean, Arthur Godfrey is a great example, and he's a name that maybe younger people might not know, but I mean, he was a huge entertainer at the time, like the biggest star of radio, and the, you know, TV is just beginning at that point, and he's sort of this all-round entertainer guy. And he and Duke hit it off well, and Arthur Godfrey loved Hawaii, went over there all the time, appeared on his shows with, you know, the Hawaiian aloha shirts and that
right.
sort of strumming a ukulele and that sort of thing. Arthur, you know, made big noises in the newspaper saying, you know, Hawaii should just pay Duke $100,000 just to be Duke.
Yeah.
And, you know, you couldn't quite do that by then because now you're a state and you've got, you know, governors and politicians involved.
you know,
it's a little different. But I think everybody sort of agreed, you know.
Totally.
Just fly him out to these events and so forth. And in a sense, that's what Kemo McVeigh adopts. Yeah, he saw the value of Duke, and he saw what surfing was becoming. He saw that surfing was not just, you know, after the Gidget and after all those crazy, silly movies of Hollywood, you know, surfing was becoming cool.
Mm-hmm.
And it was becoming its own culture and industry, and there were magazines about it and movies, and kids were loving it. And Kemo was smart enough to position Duke as, well, if you want to see where, at a time, by the way, when people wanted authentic heroes.
Right.
They didn't want to hear politicians gab because we weren't trusting politicians in the 60s and Vietnam era, that sort of thing. We wanted authentic heroes. There was no more authentic hero than Duke Kahanamoku.
Right.
And when he would come to Huntington or, you know, San Diego or wherever, you know, Australia, you know, looking as regal as he did and loving that people were surfing in contests and making money and having fun, that was great. It was a great symbol and a great great move by both parties to embrace the Hawaiian roots of surfing through this guy who was still there.
Right.
And was the best.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We started off the conversation kind of setting the stage of what Hawaii was like in 1890. Where does Duke leave Hawaii, and what does he leave behind?
That's a very good question. I hope I explored that a little bit.
You did.
And I think it in some ways very positive. I mean, Hawaii's now not some territory off in the Pacific. It's the 50th state.
Yeah.
And it's probably in some ways a harbinger of multicultural that we find today, let's say in California and other places. I mean, you've got the Asian influence and Hawaiian influence and European influence, etc. So you've got this mosaic, as they would say.
Sure.
You've also got, in some ways, some of the, shall we say, negative sides, maybe overbuilding, as I mentioned before, and tourism that was rampant, and people who had been there forever were fed up with that, and the natural beauty of Hawaii was in some ways in jeopardy, and what to do about that. And Duke expressed some regret about, you know, that it was overrun. And at the time, again, right at 68, there is a burgeoning nationalism movement among Native Hawaiians, where they are expressing the anger and displeasure of how what had happened, you know, in the 1890s had really taken, you know, it was American taking over the world.
Sure.
And so there is this, that's happening as well. There's resentment among Native Hawaiians for the situation. So it's a mixed bag.
Yeah, it is.
To be honest, and I think Duke was a proponent of Hawaii joining America. Obviously, a lot of his success was because he was an American citizen. But obviously, that came with some painful side effects.
Yeah, I think you know, we talk about aloha, and it's almost like it started, maybe it didn't start with Duke, but it outwardly started with Duke and his traveling the world. Like, aloha existed in Hawaii, but hadn't really expanded beyond Hawaii. So he kind of is the genesis of aloha in certain ways. And then also is kind of the end of aloha in certain ways because of the political shifts and cultural shifts. I know that was part of the epilogue of the book, was kind of like, you know, it had been overrun, and people, even the natives, didn't really have that feeling of aloha anymore. They almost wanted to stiff arm any new tourism and any new building. And so
Right. It
almost begins, and aloha almost begins and ends with Duke.
Well, I wish I could steal that from you now.
You can. It's all yours. You take it.
Yeah. No, that's a really astute point. And again, when I set out to write the book, I think part of the point was to get away from the mythology.
Right.
And so there are a lot of people, fans of Duke, oh, the ambassador of aloha, isn't that the greatest thing? And yes, I agree, it's a beautiful concept, that openness and that welcoming. But you know what? You also have to look at the reality.
Right.
And the reality is there were some negative side effects.
Right.
And you have to own that as well.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I mean, not to draw too fine a point, but I mean, when you look at Duke, in a sense, his life really, I mean, it's the you can trace the history of modern Hawaii through Duke.
Right.
And that's just, I mean, that's fascinating to
yeah.
me. That man just embodies sort of everything that happens in this span. And even, you know, that he touches all these people, even to a degree, a Barack Obama.
Right.
You know, where I mean, I dug and dug and dug to try to find a connection. And,
sure.
And we found a little, you know, a little nub of one.
Yeah.
And I called the White House to get a
copy.
Yeah, I did. They didn't get the message, apparently.
No. Send them a tweet. Well, excellent. I'm grateful for the book and the research and just having it all kind of teased apart. A lot of stuff that I don't know, had awareness of, and then a lot of things that I didn't. So,
well, thank you, Dave.
Well done. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, man.
Do you remember when we took the dream and then turned it into today together? Dreaming seems to carry me back to where I want to be.
wrapped up in your arms and feeling better.
Thank you, David Davis, for not only participating in this interview, but also just taking the time to research and write Waterman, The Life and Times of Duke Kahanamoku. Really appreciate it. If you'd like to learn more about David Davis, his website is daviddavisla.com. And of course, on surfsplendorpodcast.com, I have links to his website where you can purchase the book, photos of Duke Kahanamoku, and everything that we discussed in this episode. surfsplendorpodcast.com. Also, make sure to follow us on social media at Surf Splendor. I'll post photos of Duke on our Instagram feed and Facebook and all that sort of stuff. And then also, just want to say thank you for rating and reviewing the show. If you haven't done it already and you listen in iTunes or Stitcher, go ahead and leave a review there and rate it. And that really just helps our show's ranking. It helps other people to find the show, which again, helps this thing pick up momentum and allows us to continue to get great guests on the show. So do your part. We'll do our part by producing the content. All right. Thank you very much. This is your host, David Scales, saying thank you and reminding you, until next week when I see you again, catch a couple waves and shred on.
Eagles will fly. I love you more than the stars in the sky. Yes, I love you, girl. Yes, I love you, girl.